week of September 1st, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 460, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at Highclere Castle in Hampshire, England, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, geez, I have no idea what the heck that even means.
That's the real castle where they filmed Downton Abbey.
Oh, okay, because the Downton Abbey movie, I keep seeing these. I was at CineShow last week in Dallas, and there was the big standee for the Downton Abbey movie, and all I could think of was, wait a second, I never saw a single episode of that movie, and everybody's talking about this movie being like a huge hit because of a certain demographic attending. How long is it going to take me to watch like 900 seasons of Downton Abbey?
Well, there aren't that many seasons. People are professional binge watchers now. You shouldn't have too much trouble. But it comes out on September 20th. It opens opposite Rambo, Last Blood.
Talk about counter-programming.
And Brad Pitt in Ad Astra. And the James Gray sci-fi drama. And a few other things. I think it's Star Wars for old people. That's what I think Downton Abbey is. I think this is real. I mean, my mom has bought 11 tickets. She and her friends are going. They're dressing up. They're having high tea beforehand. Old people do not buy tickets well in advance. And yet it's already had some really good tracking numbers compared to movies like Mamma Mia 2 and so on. Whatever they're predicting for this movie, and I think they're saying like 13 or 15 million opening weekend and Rambo will do better. I bet this does better than the predictions. And of course, it's going to have long legs. I cannot think of a similar movie geared to adults that was sort of a franchise, a property like this, maybe Mamma Mia 2 or something. But you really have to scratch your head. Older people do not turn out on opening day or opening weekend. That's the truism. Their movies, if they appeal, tend to have really good legs. But this movie was a hot TV series. It ended before it wore out its welcome. It was still very, very popular all over the world. It has a strong core female audience, a strong older viewership, and they're hungering for more. And believe me, if you're anywhere near old people, they promote this on PBS constantly. Every pledge drive, there's like, let's chat with the maid about the new movie. Let's show a 10-second clip from the movie. Let's have a 2-hour special hosted by the butler or the footman. And it goes on and on and on. This really is going to be one of the big older adult trending movies of the year. I think it's really going to surprise people.
I agree with you. And what's funny is that the, interesting, all of the cinema operators that were at CineShow last week were talking about how their mothers were saying, is it okay that I come dressed up?
Were they really? That's hilarious. Yeah. No, my mom was petrified. I was like, they've gone on sale. I had to let her know the second they did. And it was like 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And she said, oh my God, I have to buy. I'm like, you can go in the morning and buy tickets. You'll be fine. She's like, well, but what if it sells out? I go, it will not sell out for the showtime you want. Within the first 12 hours, I go, it just won't. She's like, but I go, it won't. And there were 10 other sick tickets sold on the opening day in that one theater in Birmingham, Alabama. She bought a row of 11 tickets, and I'm sure as we get close, it will sell out a little bit more, but this is going to be people walking up that day, that weekend, and it's certainly going to run for a long time. So they're very excited by that. Alex Trebek is excited because he's back at work after a latest round of battling cancer. And Kevin Hart is in the hospital. Alex Trebek came out. Kevin Hart has gone in after a pretty bad car accident.
Yeah, actually, that car accident, when I was like, oh, gee, where did that happen? I didn't think it happened in California for some reason. But then I was looking. I was like, wow, okay, Mulholland Drive and Cold Canyon. And I said, where is Cold Canyon? And I looked it up. It's literally around the corner from me.
Yeah, it's right there.
It's in Calabasas. I was like, where is Cold Canyon? Oh, Mulholland Highway, not Mulholland Drive. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like right here.
I hope you know where Laurel Canyon is.
I do know where Laurel Canyon is. It's where all of the recording artists live.
Lived.
I know. I was going to say.
And if you go there, you have to wear flowers in your hair.
That's true.
So anyway, there's a hurricane barreling down on the eastern coast of the United States. Of course, we've had another mass shooting or two in the last 2 weeks. One loses track. I'm at the U.S. Open watching tennis all this time, but we have a podcast to do. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, it's the end of summer. As you just mentioned, we're recording on Labor Day, and appropriately enough, we've got a lot of work to do. 2 weeks of worldwide box office, the theater chain AMC raising their prices for big movies, and the buzz from Telluride and Venice are just the start. Oh, and is the summer box office down or is it up? Here's our answer Yes. We'll also discuss the biggest soap opera of the past few weeks, the breakup of Disney and Sony's unprecedented collaboration on Spider-Man, and what that means for the future of the Web Slinger. On Inside Baseball, we've got more details about Apple TV and its potential pricing, not to mention moves by Disney Plus and a report on the huge growth in video on demand. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office, not last weekend's box office, last week's box office.
That's right. And by the way, I my laptop was in the store. That's why wasn't being repaired. That's why we didn't have a show last week. That's partly my fault. You were traveling, but my computer was down. And now it's not recognizing my microphone. So I'm having to talk while I put my head facing the keyboard, but I want to look at the screen so I can read the box. It's kind of tricky.
Oh, actually, no, you can just look at the screen. Can just look at the screen. That should work.
All right. Well, it wasn't before. You were complaining. So anyway, we've got 2 weeks of box office, of worldwide box office for the entire week, the week of August 25th, and the week of September 1st. We've also got a link to Comscore in our show notes, and we also link to Box Office Mojo. But according to our stats, the number one movies for the last 2 weeks in a row have been the same. The top three, Hobbs and Shaw, The Lion King, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Those have been number one, two, and three for the last 2 weeks. Hobbs and Shaw certainly wants to thank China. It opened up in China. It's been very big. It's falling hard and fast, but it is a big franchise there, and it's been making a lot of money. Over the past 2 weeks, it has grossed $235 million. Its worldwide total is now $680 million and counting. It's going to slow down pretty soon and be done, basically. But a movie that was looking like it would struggle to hit $600 million, thanks to the second biggest market in the world, is now well above that. So it's a hit, just not a very big one compared to the last few Fast and Furious films. At number two around the world is The Lion King. Over the last 2 weeks, it has grossed $126 million. It's at $1,561 million worldwide. That's the animated but lifelike-looking remake of the animated classic. And at number three around the world is Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Over the last 2 weeks, it has grossed $102 million. It's now at $282 million worldwide. It has now officially tripled a reported budget of $90 million. That's the biggest budget of his career. It's already in the black just from box office alone. It's got a long ways to go looking at Oscars and stuff like that. So this is another good, solid success story for films geared to adults.
You know, speaking of films geared toward adults, mm-hmm. you know how we were just talking about Downton Abbey?
We were indeed.
So
old adults.
My phone buzzes and it says, hey, it's an email from The Art of Shaving. Apparently, they have a Downton Abbey collection.
Oh, well, that makes sense. That's hilarious. At number four around the world is Angel Has Fallen. That opened up last week. This week it made $40 million worldwide. It's at $70 million and counting. Again, this cost about $40 million to make for the Gerard Butler franchise. The first one was London Has Fallen, right?
Wasn't it the White House, the Olympus is down, the White House one.
Oh, Olympus
right?
has fallen, then London has fallen, now Angel has fallen. There's three fallens.
I think everything is falling.
Something else is going to fall because this costs $40 million to make. It's going to triple that easily. It's not going to make a ton of money, but there's probably something will fall. I bet something falls. At number five.
I think you're right.
Yeah. At number five, maybe, The Sky Has Fallen. That's Chicken Little. I don't know. At number five around the world is No Jia. That's the Chinese animated film. That grossed $37 million last week. It's at $685 million worldwide. That guarantees this animated film will pass The Wandering Earth to be the biggest Chinese hit of the year so far. It's one of their biggest hits of all time. The Wandering Earth topped out at $700 million worldwide. This is still going pretty strong. It's going to look more like $800 million before all is said and done. At number six around the world is a big opening. This is Saho. This is an Indian thriller. And thanks again to our audience member who sent in that link for me to help me keep track of some of the Indian box office. This is a big budget thriller. It cost about $50 million. It's a big pile of nonsense, according to the critics. It's just a nutty film, but it opened to $30 million worldwide. It needs to make a lot more, of course, to be profitable, but it opened on 4,500 screens in India. It's about a crime syndicate and a power struggle with the cops exploiting that fight to try and take them down for good. It was written and directed by Sujit, and it stars Prabhas of the Bahubali blockbuster franchise. There were two
Bahubali,
of those.
Bahubali.
No. Bahubali.
Okay.
It's Bahubali. I watched people reviewing it who are Hindi speakers online. Yes, no, it's not Bahubali.
Okay, I work with the distributor who referred to it as Bahubali.
Well, the multiple reviewers online who are clearly Hindi speakers talking in English call it Bahubali. I thought there was a slight pause like Bahubali, but it seems to be Bahubali.
If you know the correct pronunciation, yes, of that film, you should write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or better yet, call in and leave us a voicemail with the correct pronunciation, and we'll play it here on the show. You can reach us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Right. So the movie we're talking about is Saho, and it was shot simultaneously in Hindi, Tamil, Telugu, and dubbed in Malayalam. So that shows the diversity of the Indian market and the Asian market that they're trying to reach. You know, three different languages. They shot it in three different languages and dubbed it in a fourth. So they clearly know it took like 2 years to make. It's one of the bigger openings of all time for India. Certainly one of the biggest of the year. Got terrible, terrible reviews. But that never stopped a movie from making a lot of money. Look at Fast and Furious.
Look at Hobbs and Shaw.
That's what I meant. Look at Good Boys. That's the number seven film around the world. It made $18 million this week. It's at $67 million and counting. Another win because it cost about $20 million to make. And number eight around the world is the Angry Birds movie 2. Grossed $18 million this week. It's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. At number nine is Dora and the Lost City of Gold. That made another $13 million. It's at $73 million, but it's only in 34 territories. So it's probably got half the world left to go. I don't know what big markets it has. Like, has it opened in China? Will it open in China or Japan? I don't know. God, it would be great if there was a website that told you what territories a movie has opened in and where it's got to go.
Isn't that IMDb?
Well, that's not easy to do. It doesn't automatically tell you. It may never open in a territory, or it may not, you know. So that's not a guaranteed way to show every market as a movie opens. No, I don't think so. You know, because you may not know, it may be 6 months later before it's opening in China or Japan or something like that. And it doesn't always have that information in advance. It's usually only after it happens. And of course, if it closes out of a market, then it's not, it would have the release date there still. Well, I'll have to try that. I'll see if that works for me. And number 10 is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Another $13 million, and that's at $80 million worldwide. Toy Story 4 keeps chugging along, $1.043 billion. Here's a couple movies that we haven't spoken about because they came out while we were away. Ready or Not, that's the wedding night flick. Sort of a, you know, we had the one movie canceled about the red state, blue state thing. This is a woman born into a wealthy family, and on her wedding night, she finds out they're going to hunt her down and try and kill her. It's all for in fun, I guess.
You know what's interesting about that red state, blue state?
Mm-hmm.
Is that at Cineshow last week, people were really upset that movie got canceled. Not because they thought, oh, you know, that would do great in my movie theater, but they were upset that, and by the way, some of these were, you know.
Listen, you're in Dallas, yeah.
Dallas, yes, but it some of these were you know, from folks from Washington D.C. Let's put it that way. They thought that the fact that the president tweeted about it and then it was canceled, that should not be happening.
That's a bad precedent, of course.
Right.
Well, Ready or Not is also a sort of a hot button movie, though it's probably just plain as a silly fun thriller. It grossed $10 million this week. It's at $20 million and counting. It only cost about $6 million to make, so that's already a modest success story. The same can be said for the faith-based film Overcomer. $9 million it made this week. It's at $17 million. But again, a very low budget of $5 million means it's probably doing pretty darn good. And 47 Meters Down on Cage made a little bit more money. That's at $24 million. And then we have three films, two from India and a new one in China. Mission Mangal, that's the Indian drama about their space program, that's hit $35 million. That's a strong success story. Batla House, that's the Indian terrorism drama. I don't know the budget on that. It's grossed about $16 million. And then there's Vortex. So all three of these films made about $4 million. I pulled them from various sources like Variety or that website that I was pointed to. Vortex is a Chinese crime thriller about car thieves who accidentally steal a car when there's a girl in the trunk. That opened to about $4 million.
I've got to be honest, I hate it when that happens.
Oh, I know. You've gone to all the trouble to steal a nice car and there's stuff in the trunk.
Yeah. I'm just glad when that happens that they're breathing.
You know? Well, now tell me, the summer box office, was it up or was it down?
Yes.
Well, that's right. Some people looking at the traditional summer say, okay, from this date in May to this date in Labor Day, the summer box office is down 2%. Other people like Deadline Hollywood say, don't be ridiculous. The summer season began with Avengers. We've had this a couple years now. Big movies open up in late April, measuring late April to the end of summer, comparing year to date from previous years. In that case, it's up 3%. So I would say, you know what, with 12 month a year programming and people saying, hey, let's not waste any weekends, which they did waste the August Labor Day weekend. But anyway, in general, they're programming 12 months a year. I think quarterly comparisons are a little more and more misleading because sometimes the big movie opens in February. Sometimes it opens in late April. Sometimes it opens in September. So I think the thing to worry about is year to date. And the fact is, in the first quarter of 2019, we were down 12% compared to 1 year earlier. Now we're only down 6%. And remember, 1 year ago was the highest grossing year of all time. So this could be the second or third biggest grossing year of all time. It could even catch up and tie it or beat it. But the fact is, it's going to be one of the biggest grossing years of all time. We're doing good, and everything is moving in the right direction. But everybody's worried. They're saying, man, are movies too expensive? Are people losing the habit of going to the movies? And AMC is stepping into the breach. They're saying, we're going to do something about this. Let's try dynamic pricing.
You know, so dynamic pricing basically is, certainly it's being used for concerts, much to my chagrin.
And airplane tickets and all sorts of things.
It's always been used for airplane tickets, right? I mean, that's kind of,
well,
it's been like that for decades.
Not the way it is today. It used to be this, you know, once upon a time, the closer you bought it to air travel, the cheaper it was because you weren't guaranteeing a seat. But if you wanted to fly at the last minute, you could get a ticket and they had an empty seat. Then it became, no, the closer you move to flight, the more expensive it is. And it became, okay, buy it 2 weeks in advance. That's the best, or a month. You know, it just keeps changing. But the general idea of dynamic pricing is, hey, if we've got a lot of demand, we want to screw you over. We're not interested in you as a customer for life. We want to get as much money from you as possible right now. So if you have Hamilton and it's a big hot show on Broadway and everybody wants to go and you have a limited supply of tickets, you've only got, 1,200 seats a performance or a week, then you say, we can charge you through the nose, can't we? And you do.
Pretty much, yeah.
And so AMC is saying, we're going to try dynamic pricing. Sounds very concerned. In four cities, they are using it. Boston, Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, and San Diego. And I thought, well, that's great. And they talked about a price range of 50 cents to $1.50, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I thought, well, okay, if they're reducing prices, $1.50, that's something. No. AMC wants to charge a premium for in-demand movies like Avengers Endgame. So they're worried about people leaving the habit of going to the movies. They're worried about movie ticket prices. So the response is to raise them for the most popular movies.
Yeah, that's what doesn't make sense to me. What I think is interesting, like Britney runs
a marathon.
Well,
that's what dynamic pricing is. They say we want to get as much money as possible. It's not about keeping you a fan for life. It's not about making sure the people who are going to use the tickets get them rather than scalpers, or that wealthy people who aren't big fans just glom onto the latest popular thing and then move on. It's about saying we want to squeeze you for every penny we can. It may work for something that you buy once, like a car, for every 5 or 10 years. But does it work when you want them to be in the habit of going to the movies all the time?
No, because what it's done for me, at least, is when I went to see Joe Jackson and Beirut.
I like them both, especially Joe Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, I made me go, well, wait, what do you mean you're charging me more because I'm coming and the show is popular, so I pay more? Like, it made me go, you know what? Maybe I don't need to see you.
Well,
in concert.
Well, exactly. And the idea of them being, they're not experimenting with dynamic pricing. They're experimenting with raising tickets, raising the ticket price. And to be fair, when you adjust for inflation, movie tickets are about the same as they were in the 70s. So it is not that movie ticket prices have exploded in cost, though it feels like it. It's really that they've kept pace with inflation. So when you paid $3, $4, $5 in the 70s and 80s, well, now you're paying $10 to $15. And as far as I'm concerned, they already use dynamic pricing. If by that they mean trying lower prices to bring in people when demand is slow. They have matinees, they have senior prices, they have kid prices, they have all sorts of stuff. And when I look at my tickets for the last 6 months, you can look at our list on our show notes of the movies I have seen at AMC in the last 6 months. I've seen 18 movies, almost one a week because I have my AMC card. But the prices that I would have been charged in New York City, for example, three tickets I bought at $8, four tickets at $8, one at a couple at 16, another at 17, go back to Birmingham, Alabama. My ticket prices range from $10 to $18.50 for Spider-Man Far From Home. I paid more in New York, in Birmingham, than New York to see a movie. That was the most money I spent anywhere. But I had Booksmart, Rocket Man, and Toy Story 4 at $10. I had Godzilla and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood happened to cost $11. John Wick 3 was $14. The Lion King was $12. You know, you can see I wasn't trying to go to a matinee to save money. It just happened to be when I went to the movie. But it happens naturally that you see movies at a lower price during the day or matinees, or if you're a scene, you know, they're doing dynamic pricing if you mean they're trying to make sure they fill up seats when they're empty. If they mean when seats are full, we want to get even more money, well, knock yourself out. But that's a great way to make sure people don't go to the movies.
Yeah, I think dynamic pricing. Ironically, this was not a topic that was discussed a lot at CineShow at all, mainly because it's one exhibitor doing it in like 5-6 cities. But the whole idea of dynamic pricing is, as you say, Michael, get more people into the theater for films that might be in their final weeks or films that might
That's not what they mean by it.
Oh, I know that. I know that.
Yeah, well, let's call what we want discount ticket prices. You know, you've got a level that you charge, and you should charge less when the theater is empty. It's not about charging more when it's Friday night and you've got a lot of people who want to go to the movies. That's a dumb way to do it. That's dumb, especially when you want repeat business. These are not people you get once a year. If you're going to Le Cirque once a year for a dinner, you're going to pay a ton of money. But if you want someone to come to your restaurant every week or every 2 weeks, you can't charge them an arm and a leg, even when you've got a really good, you know, meal on that night.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, a movie like Britney Runs a Marathon.
Right.
Okay. This is a movie that you didn't talk
about.
But
I don't think you should change the prices based on what the movie is. Oh, that's a low budget movie or a big budget movie. That's my whole thing. Don't change the price based on the movie or just try to bring in more people when seats are emptier. Someone said online, they said, hey, how about just charging matinee prices Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday all day, every day for movies that aren't opening up on a Wednesday night or really a Tuesday night? You know, so if it's a movie that's been out already, just charge matinee prices those 3 days of the week. They're always lower grossing. Most people don't go to the movies those nights. That brings in people. You've got $5 Tuesdays at AMC. Why not expand that to Monday and Wednesday for movies that are already in the theaters?
Yeah, I think I agree.
They've got
with
a
you.
Lot
of
inventory sitting there.
There's, of course, the backlash. I don't want to say backlash, but the counter argument is, well, gee, if you are doing it where, oh, well, gee, Britney Runs a Marathon, just going back to that again, just because I can, really.
Yeah.
Well, gee, that movie didn't cost $450 million to make.
That's beside the point. It's a 2-hour experience in the theater, and either it's a good movie or a bad movie, and the budget of the film does not make it a fun, entertaining movie. My Big Fat Greek Wedding was a hugely successful movie, and other movies that cost $250 million, you know, charge me less for Godzilla when it's horrible? Okay. But that's the whole point. You cannot judge the quality or the desire to see a movie based on its budget. It's just 2 hours of movie watching. That's all it is. Doesn't matter what they paid to make it. If I want to see it and I want to go see the Blair Witch Project, huzzah for you. But that doesn't mean because you spent $200 million, I should suddenly spend, you know, $80 to see it. It doesn't work
right.
That
way. And so my where I was headed with that was the fear of, well, gee, this movie only costs $6 to see. It must not be very good. Forget the budget, but it must not be very good.
You don't do it based on the movie. You do it based on the time of day or the day of week, or the person is an audience member who's a senior or a kid. You don't do it based on the movie. You do it saying, hey, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we got a lot of empty seats. That's why AMC has $5 or $6 Tuesdays. That's why there are matinee prices before 1 o'clock or whatever it might be. That's why there were early bird specials once upon a time. So you do it based on the inventory of seats and you know, the traditional amount of seats you have. You say, all right, Monday,
Tuesday, Wednesday, but think about it this way. If the inventory of seats is very low because the movie is really popular,
it's not about... It's about the traditional audience going habit. It's not about I'm opening weekend of Avengers Endgame. It's about saying I've got 365 days a year and I want people to show up Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays or before noon when I've got a theater open, 1,000 seats available, and nobody's here. So what do? I lower my tickets. It's not about saying it's opening weekend for Avengers. Let's charge them through the nose because you want them to come back 2 weeks later to see Brittany Runs a Marathon.
Yeah, good movie, by the way. You should go see it.
Well, I will. I bought an AMC ticket card. I spent $144 on that subscription over the last 6 months. I bought what amounts to $236 in tickets. Half those movies, at least, I would not have seen if I didn't have the card.
So I guess that's the thing. Like, what, you know, when people say, oh, you know, piracy is really costing the music industry so much money. And by the way, it did.
It does. But yeah, absolutely.
But not every single thing that was pirated, somebody would have purchased.
No, absolutely. But it gets you in the habit of not purchasing. That's for sure.
Right. No, I agree that there.
That's, I wish I could 100%. Pirate the movies that were playing at Telluride in Venice. It sounds like some really good reviewed movies came out of there.
Why would you pirate them? Wouldn't you go see them with your brand new card?
Well, sadly, a lot of these movies don't play at AMC. They might play the art houses.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you tell us about some of them? Now, ideally, we will try and get Ann Thompson on in the next few weeks to tell us all about them. But that said,
In the meantime, the big news, I think, was that, you know, Khan was agitating and getting upset and nervous about Netflix and Amazon and all the streamers. Telluride and Venice said, bring it on. We're happy. And guess what? Netflix scored with The Two Popes, a movie starring Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce, and Marriage Story, directed by Noah Baumbach, to the best reviews of his career. Amazon scored with The Aeronauts, which is a movie starring Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones. Is that her name? And yes. The Report, which is a little more modestly received, but still some very good reviews. And of course, Martin Scorsese's The Irishman is coming to the New York Film Festival. The fact is, if you ignore the streamers, you are going to be ignoring some of the best films of the year, or perhaps the best TV movies of the year if you're Steven Spielberg.
Right. Well, and they are actually playing the Irishman, Netflix is. They're going to be releasing it for at least 3 to 4 weeks in theaters.
Well, we know exactly when they're releasing it. They're for 26 days in theaters. They tried to cut a deal with the major exhibitors, but it didn't work. They said, how about 30-day window? And the exhibitors said, how about 90, like we always say? So they've given up. They can't make a deal with the major chains. They're releasing it only on indie screens, which means I won't have my AMC pass. That comes out November 1st, and on November 27th, the day before Thanksgiving, it hits Netflix. They may, of course, keep it in theaters if it's still making money, but they offered a 30-day window as opposed to this 26 days, and the chains would not bite.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't blame them. I mean, I think the second that the chains let Netflix do something for only 30 days, what do you think? You think? I almost said 20th Century Fox, but I may as well say Disney. But you think Universal isn't going to come along and say, well, we'll do the same thing. And Warner Brothers with their own streaming platform, they're going to do the same thing. Well, we want it for 30, you know, only 30 days too.
Well, here's my problem. If it was the Will Smith movie, that one that aired on Netflix, the sort of Alien Nation spinoff or whatever that was.
Oh, God, yeah. Bright, yeah.
Yeah, you know, something like that is a big blockbuster movie that does indeed get most of its audience within the first month. In which case, I think everybody works together and says, yeah, you know, it's, again, I've always been of the mind like, well, once it's petered out at the box office, why do you care if it goes to a streamer quicker? You know, the idea is, yes, you know, it's already 90 days and it's going to be on demand and DVD and Blu-ray immediately, right? 3 months, boom, there it is. That used to freak them out. As far as I'm concerned, if your movie is played out and it's not in the top 30 or 40 anymore, it's off most screens, why would you still insist it stay moribund for another 2 months?
So, well, part of it is, you know, I guess, let me ask you this.
But I guess that means it has to be on a case-by-case basis, and who gets to make that decision? To me, it's right. a simple fact of, all right, it's off, you know, it debuted on 1,000 screens, and now it's dropped off 90% of them. If you want to release it to streaming, you can. But my counter-argument to Netflix is, this is a movie that's 3 hours and 20 minutes long. It costs $200 million to make. It apparently looks good and could be seen on a big screen. If you're lucky enough that after 30 days people still wanted to see it, you should be thrilled. You may not lose all your money on it. I would think you'd want, this is the sort of movie that should play for a long time in theaters. So beyond the chain saying we want it to, or we demand it run for 90 days, I would think you'd want it to, especially if it's an Oscar hopeful. That just gets you to, you know, November, December, January, and then you're ready to put it on DVD, Blu-ray, or in this case, Netflix.
Well, in business school, one of the things they teach you about, specific to pricing, is about hardcover books versus softcover books and the timing of them. And it's about product versioning, et cetera. But what they kind of say is, and this was really the always the example that was used, for some reason, whenever this conversation came up, Stephen King was mentioned every single time. They said, for a Stephen King fan who wants to read every book Stephen King writes, they're going to want to get it in hardcover, they're going to want to get it first, and for that privilege, they have to pay a little extra, $25. Now, if you're, you know, whatever, you're an okay fan, you're going to buy a Stephen King book at the airport, well, maybe you'll buy that book a year from now when it's in paperback, you'll pay less for it, but and you don't get it right away, but you know what, you don't care.
And how does that apply to movies and now?
Well, you know,
because every movie is new in a way, unless you think Scorsese is, you know, that name brand sort of thing. The fact is that if you buy a book today, it comes out in hardcover and it comes out in ebook for half the price. And it's available on digital audio. And if you're in the UK, it's available in hardcover, paperback, ebook, and audio simultaneously on the day it comes out. They say, you watch it the way you want to watch it. You know, whatever you want to do is happy with us. Just do what you want. So, you know, maybe Netflix is a hey. If they want to go to the theaters, they can, but if they want to stream it, they can. And that happens for a lot of movies now. A lot of small, tiny movies come out on video on demand first, or they stream first, and then they hit theaters, or they hit theaters and stream simultaneously. It's just the big, big movies where this is still an issue.
So yeah, let's not pretend that this isn't the... Yeah.
Well, what do you mean less and less?
It used to be, you're right, where they would release the movie first, believe it or not, on you know, like iTunes.
Yeah, like IFC and Sundance and stuff. That happens still all the time. Or simultaneously, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, there. Well, yeah, simultaneously.
Well,
yes.
That's very different from what the chains are complaining about. But we're just we're down to talking about the big movies. Let's not pretend the system hasn't changed dramatically. This happens all the time. So when the chains say, "Oh my God, no, it has to be a 90-day window," well, guess what? A lot of these movies are not 90-day windows.
You know, last year when I was at Sundance, a lot of the art house. Exhibitors were telling me that they were doing incredibly well with Roma, which of course was a Netflix film, Alfonso Cuarón, 3 Academy Awards, was nominated for Best Picture. Now it was January, the film had come out December 15th. I was unable to see it in a theater. I still wanted to see it in a theater and couldn't because it wasn't playing anywhere near me. And every time it did,
you're in LA.
Yeah, well, because, you know, all the LA theaters had dropped it because it was now on Netflix.
I thought it was still here in New York. It still ran in theaters even after it was on Netflix. It didn't stop.
Yes, correct. Yes, that is true. In
most places. But you're saying LA has a company town vibe and they just refused?
Yeah, most of the theaters did kind of pull it after it.
In LA, not around the country.
Correct. Yes, okay. We're talking about LA. Correct.
All right.
So, but they were saying they were doing really well. In fact, they were upset when Netflix pulled the print, and that is probably more accurate as to what happened in Los Angeles. Netflix came in and said, no, it's on Netflix now. We need the prints back.
But no, it's playing everywhere. It was playing everywhere else in theaters.
That's what people were upset with. And by the way, it wasn't just, you know, Los Angeles. There were art houses that said, well, wait, I said I'd play it. And yes, I guaranteed you 2 weeks, but I want to play it a third or a fourth. And Netflix said, yeah, no, sorry.
Well, so New York was the rare city where they were allowed to keep showing the movie?
I guess so. I don't know why.
Okay. Well, I think that's what will happen with The Irishman, because there's no way everybody's going to cram into theaters in the opening few weeks and see that movie. It's 3 hours and 20 minutes long.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
You know, they're fools to try to yank it from theaters if they do, because I think there'll be a demand for it. That's going to be an Oscar hopeful. And some studio flicks beyond the streamers made good news. Ford versus Ferrari, Judy, the Judy Garland biopic starring Renee Zellweger, and Uncut Gems, the Safdie brothers movie starring Adam Sandler in his contractual once every 5 years, you know, good movie. Every 5 years, he insists on making at least one good movie. And this is apparently it. So there's a lot of interesting flicks coming out of the film festivals.
Yeah, I look forward to I look forward to seeing.
And I look forward to seeing a movie about the backstory behind Spider-Man, because while we were gone, all people kept asking me about this. Disney and Sony going their separate ways on the Spider-Man franchise. And what would this mean for the Marvel Universe? And what would it mean for Spider-Man? And who was the bad guy? And who was the good guy? It was very, very dramatic.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. We talked about this last week when we were realizing, oh my gosh, we can't actually do a show this week. And we were saying, you know, effectively Disney bought, you know, like DC, but without Batman, you know, it's like, and Superman. They bought Marvel, most recognizable character, arguably, is Spider-Man.
Absolutely.
And they didn't get Spider-Man. That belongs to Sony. And they cut this deal, which seemed like a really good idea, that you know, Spider-Man could go back and forth and Disney would help out and Marvel would help out with the Sony movies. And likewise, Spider-Man could kind of be in some of the Disney movies. And I guess Disney came along and said, you know what, we actually want to co-finance those at 50%, which, by the way, of course, means we get 50% of the profits. Sony said, hey, did you know that one of our most successful franchises was it's Spider-Man, and we don't want to give up that money. So here's what we say to that offer. No, we don't need you to basically co-finance a sure thing. We can do that ourselves.
Well, to be clear, the back and forth over whom to blame and what happened could be compared to Rashomon. It's been so, you know, Disney was like, Sony ruined everything. And Sony said, gosh, I just wish we could be friends because, you know, we broke up, but it's, you know, we love each other. It's been really great. It's really nice knowing, you know, like nobody wants to take the blame. Nobody, you know, some of them are bad mouthing each other off the record. The explanation for what's going on. It's all about money, obviously. And it's clear Sony at least offered maybe 25% of the budget in exchange for 25% of the revenue, which would have meant on Spider-Man Far From Home, they paid maybe $40 million and got roughly $120 million back, which would be pretty good for them, wouldn't it? I mean, it just seems a silly deal for Sony. Why would they do it? The problem is Spidey is interwoven into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's practically the lead character. The storyline has been building to him becoming the next sort of leader of the Avengers, a la Iron Man. And how they're going to unwind that, I don't know. Creatively, it'll be fine. And let's remember, you know, everybody says Disney helps Sony so much. Well, you know, when Spidey joined the Marvel Universe, that deal came about after Thor: The Dark World, which was not a particularly well-reviewed movie. They weren't sure how the franchise and all these different movies were going to do. They wanted and needed Marvel's most popular character. So that helped them a lot. I don't think Spidey made the movies. They would have been very successful anyway. Disney's done a great job. But Spider-Man really matters. So it was good for everyone. And it's a shame it had to fall apart. But it's money and it's complicated. Sony sold off the merchandising rights to Spider-Man to Disney for $175 million flat. I have no idea why they did that.
There must have been, I mean, I am sure that in the contract, there must be some reason why that happened. I don't know what it is, but there must be some contractual reason where they were like, you know what, even though this looks like a bad deal, everybody in this room will know why we did this and it's not such a bad deal.
Yeah, I'd love to know that explanation because that makes no sense whatsoever. At the very least, you would demand a cut of the proceeds, right? Whatever
deal
you made, you'd say at least, you know, we're going to get whatever. But oh my God. On the other hand, Disney was paying Sony $30 million a year royalty just for the having Spidey in their Marvel movies. So, you know, Sony did not get a piece of the Disney movies. They didn't get a certain percentage of the revenue. They got a flat $30 million a year royalty. The better their own Spider-Man movies did, which Disney helped them with, the lower the royalty payment. So obviously with this one being the highest grossing Sony film ever, maybe they paid nothing. But at least that was an obligation that they had to face. So, you know, it's very complicated. And you've got, how do you say his name? Kevin Feige, right? He's got a lot on his plate. Another Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Thor. He's launching the Eternals. He's relaunching Blade with Idris Elba, relaunching the X-Men franchise, and presumably Fantastic Four at some point. But believe me, he was not too busy to work on Spider-Man. So, you know, this is all about money. And now they're going to fight over director John Watts. He made the first two Spider-Man films. Now Disney wants him. His contract is open. He's free. Who does he go with? Does he stay with Sony or does he go with Marvel, who can give him a lot more toys to play with? Who's the winner? Who's the loser?
Well, I think certainly Disney's the loser, right? Mm-hmm. I think everybody looks at it and goes, well, you know, Disney's getting their comeuppance. Well, no, they're not. They're just not going to have Spider-Man for a while. And, you know, Sony gets to keep Spider-Man.
Yeah, they get to keep Spider-Man. They were going to keep Spider-Man, obviously. I think they both lose in a way and they'll both be fine. You know, Spidey stands on his own completely. That's not a problem. And the Marvel movies will figure it out. They had Spidey being, you know, the next leader, but they'll do something else.
Yeah, maybe it'll be, I don't know, the Hulk.
Hulk is big. He's very big.
And wait a second.
Does he ever say woofs? I'm not sure.
Yeah. I see what you're doing there. Okay. I see. Because it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story this week. Well, okay. Here's a startling fact. YouTube star Ryan Kaji is a 7-year-old kid with his own channel called Ryan Toys Review. Okay, shouldn't it be like Ryan Reviews Toy, whatever. He's 7, you know, maybe he didn't know grammar at that point. He unboxes toys and he looks at all the neat stuff inside the boxes and he gives his first impression. It's adorable, right? I mean, come on. And it's also very profitable, apparently. In 2018, he grossed... Now, Michael, are you sitting down?
I'm standing, actually.
Okay, you'll be sitting down in a moment because all this kid does is open a box of toys and talk about them, okay? Yeah, 2018, grossed $22 million.
What are your kids doing? You've got your kids in the next room. Get them to work.
I know. Right now, they're bothering me because they're being noisy, and I'm sure it's being picked up on this mic. You know what? You're absolutely right. I should put them to work. They can open up
anything.
Start
live streaming them. Yeah.
Yes. They're cleaning the kitty litter box. Come on. That's got to be worth at least like $1.50, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're, you know, basically what we're trying to say here is a new federal law protecting underage social media stars, which my kids will be soon. Well, that new law is needed. Movie history buffs, they all know about the Jackie Coogan law. He was a child actor who sued his parents after they spent all the money he'd earned. The Coogan law demands 15% of a child actor's revenue be set aside in a blocked trust for when the child turns 18 years old. There is no such law protecting kids who are social media stars, which is why, as soon as my kids become those social media stars and make all that money, I'm spending it. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's, well, it's just an article in the Hollywood Reporter, but it's a big deal. It's a good thing to point out. We've got a link to their story in our show notes. It's absolutely true. Yeah, and you know, kids don't even have the right to say no. You know, do you have the right to say you don't want to be on your parents' Facebook page and have them tweet out photos of you every minute of every day? You don't really legally, but it's an interesting area, especially when money's involved. Kids need to be protected.
Because haters just gotta hate. Someone posted a story asking if Taylor Swift was yesterday's news. That's pretty odd since Swift just dropped her new album. It debuts at number one on the Billboard charts with the biggest one-week number since, well, Taylor Swift's last album, Reputation. She sold 679,000 actual physical albums.
Or digital.
You're right. Well, that's along with hundreds of millions of streams, of course. No surprise since it's her sixth number one album so far. With a big tour about to happen, Swift is looking towards the future and the past. She's still angry that her catalog was sold off to the one person she likes least in the music industry, Scooter Braun. Swift announced she plans to re-record every single album from her past so they can compete with her old masters on streaming sites and the like. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal that her new album opened at number one. She's got a big tour coming. She's showing she's still a big star and will be for a decade or two to come, for sure. She's never going anywhere. I don't think it's possible at this stage. It's also a big whoop in terms of re-recording her old albums. This has happened a lot, even in the old days. You know, Chuck Berry or Fats Domino or someone would sign to a new record label. The first thing they would do is say, hey, let's, you know, record your big hits, because they want to sell a greatest hits package too, but they don't have the rights to the original masters. So if you weren't paying attention in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, you might be buying an album that wasn't the classic Chuck Berry tunes you wanted, but a recent version of that song. They might still be good. And in fact, a Roy Orbison recording of his big hits for Virgin Records. That's one of my favorite Roy Orbison albums. It's a terrific collection. But, you know, it's not usually what you want. You usually want the original masters. So it's a clever ploy on her part. Maybe her fans will champion her and do that and support those albums. I think in the long run, it won't mean that much, especially since the days of sales, especially for albums that have been out 10 or 20 years, those are probably in the past.
Right, but she can't, for instance, and the reason she wants to own her albums, she can't go and say, pull all of my albums from Spotify.
Well, no, of course not, but she can add the new, you know, new versions of them and say, and tell her fans, listen to my 2020 version of, you know, my debut album.
Right, and what it could potentially do for
Scoot. It'll confuse people and all that, and maybe lower his royalties a smidge.
Right, and you know, he paid $300 million for you know, the record company that contained all that music. Well, now...
It muddies the waters a little bit, but I don't think it'll make a big difference.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Speaking of muddy waters, and I'm not talking about the musician, the Writers Guild of America is moving its lawsuits against the major talent agencies to federal court. The agents are launching,
They're laughing.
They're launching and laughing. Maybe they're launching their laughs because they're saying, see, you know you were going to lose on the state level. The WGA said, whatever. Shopping for venues is perfectly normal. Everybody does it. Plus, they know federal judges run a tight ship and do not stand for any nonsense during discovery, where important information must be disclosed. All those emails are going to come back to haunt everybody. I can tell you that right now. Remember the agency sued first? So this is actually a countersuit. It claims packaging fees violate the agency's fiduciary duty to their clients, not to mention an illegal kickback scheme and price fixing. They say the agencies are also engaged in a collusive agreement not to negotiate one-on-one with the WGA and to blacklist writers who oppose their business practices. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think the change in venue is a big whoop. It's, I'm sure, a smart strategic move. But one of the four agencies is not included. I'm not quite sure why. ICM is not part of this lawsuit. William Morris Endeavor, CAA, UTA, they are all named, but ICM is not. I don't remember why. But
yeah, I kind of remember reading about why and then kind of immediately forgetting.
Exactly. In a sign of possible strength for those calling for negotiations overall, the SAG-AFTRA elections happened. Gabriel Carteris won re-election to the head of them, but the faction calling for more confrontation, a la the people who are heading the WGA right now, they're about to have their own elections. That group led by Matthew Modine did not win the presidency, but they did make a lot of gains at the board level. So maybe it's a little mixed there.
Yeah, and of course, there are people inside the WGA who are like, you know what, we need to stand together and go talk to the agencies. I'm sure everything will be fine. We'll be able to work it out, especially since we are the group of people that is working nonstop. And,
like John Wells, who just said, who supported the faction that says, hey, we need to negotiate and sit back down with them and not be so, you know, confrontational.
Yeah, I don't know how you're going to negotiate with them. I mean, the agencies stand to lose pretty much everything.
Well, you negotiate by dropping the argument that you want them to drop packaging fees. You can't negotiate that. Either they do it or they don't. They offered like less than 1% of their packaging fee, you know, income. That was their unasked for offer. You know, what, they're going to get 50%. You say, well, why don't we have it all? Why do you get it? Why don't you get 10% of it and we get 90 like everything else? But that's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe what the agencies could offer is, look, that, you know, you get paid to do your work, okay, writers, you get paid, and we get 10% of it, okay? So you do the work, we get 10% of it. Packaging is our work, okay? That's what we do, okay? So why don't you get 10% of that, and we get 90% since
because
we're being paid for our work.
You wouldn't get any of the packaging if it wasn't for us. It's not work. It's just a way of getting money that you shouldn't get otherwise and keeping it
right.
from the writers.
Yeah. Look, man, I'm just trying to play nice with everybody. All right. Well, a study of the top 100 movies of the year from 2007 to 2018 shows exactly what everybody assumed, especially me, thought. Latin and Hispanic actors are virtually invisible. Only 4.5% of all speaking roles included a Latin or Hispanic actor. Only 3% of films included a Latin or Hispanic lead or co-lead.
To clarify, these are 100 of the 100 top movies of each year. So we're looking at, you know, like 1,100 movies now.
Yeah. Right. So some 17 of those roughly 35 lead or co-lead roles were women, and 5 of those lead roles were played by Cameron Diaz. Okay, so add in Jennifer Lopez, and you can see how few opportunities there are for Latin and Hispanic actors of any gender. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, especially when you realize how big and growing the Latin and Hispanic audience is for movie going. They want to see themselves on the big screen. That's why Fast and Furious is a big franchise. People like to see themselves in the movies. And they're not responding to the audience that is growing bigger and bigger all the time. They would be smart to do so.
Did we need a study for that? I feel like, you know, ultimately, well, I could have told you that.
It's good to put in the numbers and say, this is how really actually awful and bad it is. It really wakes you up, especially when you realize how strong a movie-going audience they are. That's just pretty darn dumb.
A major lawsuit against Universal Music Group and that devastating fire which destroyed so much precious music history is now underway. But it's been amended, with the band Hole dropping out after Universal insisted none of their masters were harmed. Indeed, Universal insists many of the acts named in the lawsuit over the 2008 fire have not had their masters destroyed at all. The label went on to say it has a dedicated global team working to provide accurate information as to what assets they have and what might or might not have been lost. A lawyer responded rather sarcastically by releasing a statement to Variety that read, "Well, isn't that great? After 11 years of assuring artists that basically nothing was lost in the fire, Universal Music Group is actually conducting an investigation as to what was lost in the fire. Still, suing are the artists or the estates of Tupac Shakur, Tom Petty, Soundgarden, and Steve Earle. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I mean, Hole dropped out of the deal because they've been reassured that their stuff has not been lost, but the label is just digging a bigger and bigger hole for itself.
No pun intended.
Pun intended, absolutely. I mean, they're like, no, everything's fine. Well, we don't actually know what we have, but we're finding out. It's like, well, then you can't possibly claim that most of those people's stuff, you don't know. And I think it took them 2 weeks and they insisted they looked at all 2 million pieces of stuff in that one location. They know exactly everything's fine. It's like, that's absurd. That can't be done. You cannot look at 2 million items and find out whether they are playable or usable or damaged whatsoever. It's not physically possible. So they keep contradicting themselves. It's a big disaster. And the first thing they need to do is an actual inventory and start to properly account for what they have. And they're not done yet.
The ABC competition show Dancing with the Stars. Oh, that's still on? Well, it has often booked unlikely contestants. Heck, that's half the appeal of the show. So it probably didn't expect much blowback when it announced the new season would include disgraced White House spokesperson and professional liar Sean Spicer. Or maybe it did. Critics denounced the show, and even its host, Tom Bergeron, felt obliged to speak out. He said that Dancing with the Stars is meant to be an escape from everyday troubles, and that booking Spicer and other controversial political figures works against that. He urged them not to do it, but they have anyway.
He was absolutely right, by the way.
Spicer could make six figures, depending on how far he makes it in the contest, but ABC will make more since this is all about ratings. And you know what happens? Here's the thing. No matter what the ratings are with Sean Spicer on, he will go and hold a press conference and say they were the biggest numbers to ever watch Dancing with the Stars ever, period. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's not that big a deal, but it was an obnoxious thing for them to do. But what do they care? They just want to make money. This is why American Crime Story is dramatizing Bill Clinton's impeachment fight right before a presidential election. They could wait till the February sweeps of the few months later, but they want to do it right before the election to make as much money as possible. They don't care about public opinion or what happens in the country. They just want to make their bucks.
Well, you know, I think that what was interesting to me about all of this was the reaction from people who were like, Dancing with the Stars is still on? I guess it is.
That's a big hit. That's not the right reaction because it's a big hit. People watch it. It's very popular.
I agree. And I was like, wow, you know.
Well, there's 500 shows on TV. People don't, I don't know half the things that are on, but that's a big one.
Right. And so there was that. And then there was the kind of political ramifications of this. And what I mean by that is not, okay, putting the television aside for a second, was because we've already discussed like what the entertainment response was the political response of, wow, yeah, this is what happens when, you're a part of the current administration. It's the after effect of, well, how do you then move on from this? Is this the best Sean Spicer could do? Was Dancing with the Stars? He couldn't get a job anywhere else.
He's thrilled. What are you talking about? Even if he had another job on CNN or somebody else as a commentator, he'd be thrilled to be on Dancing with the Stars. This is not desperate last minute. This isn't MTV's halfway house. This is, this were for losers. This is a valuable thing. People who are already popular, people become more popular. It's a great platform for anyone. Oh, look at lovable Sean Spicer doing the tango. It humanizes him and makes him nice. Himmler, why not let his staff and Goebbels, why not let their staff come on the show? And, as I recall from the movie The Producers, the Fuhrer was a wonderful dancer.
And he wrote great songs.
Yes. And so, your point is, you're normalizing people who are taking part in an administration that is violating the law day and night. And you say, well, Democrats, Republicans. I never said you couldn't have someone from George W. Bush's administration on Dancing with the Stars. You had hateful people on there before I didn't like. This is different.
No, in fact, Rick Perry was
Hateful person who hates gay people and has devoted his life to demanding gay people not have basic civil rights. Not someone I'd want on my show. I'm not looking to have, Jeff Sessions be on Dancing with the Stars. I think that would be hateful and wrong. Why do you want somebody that half your audience is going to say, that guy hates me? Why are you having someone on a show that's divisive? That's Tom Bergeron's point, and I think he's right. This is an escapist, friendly, family-friendly show, and they're turning it into a stunt, and an ugly stunt at that.
Well, okay. So my point was actually more the talk on political commentary was, hey, is this the best? You know, in other words, he's already
failed to get a job, something. But again, this would not be a bad move, even if he had those jobs. He'd be even more likely to get it if he'd had that job at CNN that he wanted. So this is not a desperate last minute thing. This is a useful platform for damn near anyone who wants to do that sort of junk.
So what you're saying is you will be on Dancing with the Stars next season.
I will not.
Okay, just checking. Joseph Campbell
Cut
is a
to
legend.
Me doing a tango.
Eminem's company, 8 Mile, has hired the lawyer behind the landmark Blurred Lines lawsuit, and now he's suing Spotify. Eminem says the streaming service infringed on the hundreds of copyrights by playing his music without proper authorization, although I guess Spotify could say, we didn't play it, our subscribers played it. He says the claim that Spotify couldn't figure out who held the copyright to the Oscar and Grammy-winning number one smash hit Lose Yourself is kind of ridiculous. Without good faith effort, without that effort, they are negligent. Spotify's negligent. Oh, and the Music Modernization Act, which was intended to make it easier for all involved in digital music and streaming, what about that? Yeah, that's unconstitutional. Big yellow, big whoop.
Well, it's a big whoop until it comes to court and things actually happen and there's a ruling. Most likely they will settle out of court, but it's that last zinger about the Music Modernization Act that is really telling. This lawyer, Richard Bush, I mean, he's had a hell of a career. Obviously, the Blurred Lines lawsuit, which we think was wrongly decided, but he won. And he was also part of a really big decision earlier that was working with Eminem's company as well, where they were fighting over how digital downloads were classified. Were they licenses or were they sales? Music labels were using one definition so they could pay artists a lower royalty rate, and then using another definition when they were charging the streamers. So they did whatever benefited them one minute to the next. And he said, you can't do that. And they're saying that the Music Modernization Act is unconstitutional because it's an unfair taking of his property. It retroactively gave streamers a pass for past infringement if people didn't sue by a certain date. And because of what they were paying out and how it all works, it turns out that they're ensuring that the cost of suing would be greater than the damages you could obtain. So they're saying, you know, 8 Mile, Eminem's company, saying that's just not right. We had something valuable and you've taken it away from us unconstitutionally. We simply don't have the right to, you know, claim our value from that anymore because you took it away, and that should be.
Well, you have the right to claim it, but you don't have the, you know, it makes no economic sense to do so.
Well, they had something very valuable and it was given away for pennies, and they have no ability to sue and get meaningful recompense.
Well, and the issue with the lawsuit against Universal Music Group was that and this was a while ago and we talked about it on previous episodes, but just as a recap, basically, when you buy a digital download, so you purchased it and you've downloaded that music, well, Universal Music Group says, well, you don't own that, Michael.
Right.
You're just renting it. It's a license for you to listen to it. Well, Eminem came along and said, well, if that's the case,
then I get an 80%, then I get 50%. I get an 80% royalty rather than the 30% or 10% that you get if it's a sale. Exactly. That's a good one.
And they said, well, no, we sold it. And they're like, really?
Well, you told them it's a license. Yes.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That was a big case. So Richard Bush, he's got a heck of a career going.
John Campbell is a legend in the world of sci-fi and fantasy.
Or what? He's dead.
Yeah, well, in the early days when sci-fi was a joke, read only by dorky teens,
like
Campbell was editing Astounding Magazine and launched the careers of iconic writers like Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Robert Heinlein, also all dead. It was a very male, very white world, and Campbell reveled in it. He seriously tackled L. Ron Hubbard's new science fiction, it's like science turned religion, dubbed Scientology. Well, he held typically sexist views about women and held atypically racist views about race and genetics. When author Janet Ng won the John W. Campbell Best New Writer Award from Astounding this year, she pointed out his lifelong track record of virulent racism and embracing fascist ideas and wondered why they still honored his name. Well, now they don't, dropping Campbell's name and redubbing the award simply the Astounding Best New Writer. There's a lot of adjectives in that, astounding, best, and new. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things, but it was the right thing to do. And before people get all upset about political correct, it's like no one's pretending John Campbell didn't have a really major role in sci-fi, that he did a lot of good stuff and sponsored some great writers. It's just saying, but do you want to use his name as an honor? You know, do you want to take his, we're not erasing him from history. We're just saying, yeah, maybe a prize to award and celebrate new writers that people he would have hated and never wanted to have in his magazine, maybe that doesn't make so much sense. You know, it's like, no, it's all right. You're just not using his name to honor him and other people. You're not pretending he never existed or didn't do anything that was somewhat worthy. Her speech was a wake-up call. And I think it helped that it came in the wake of Alec Navalny Lee's book, Astounding, which is about that era and practically a biography of John Campbell. And it put a spotlight on kind of how awful he was on these issues, even for that era. I mean, he supported segregation. He thought slavery was a useful educational tool and so on. So he had some really bad, nutty, crazy ideas.
Yeah. Okay. So I was going to go into a story about my back to school night where my eighth grader in their U.S. history class is being taught about presentism, which is the holding people from history accountable to the ideas, thoughts, morals, and ethics of today. Mm-hmm. But if you, what you're saying is, even in his present time, he was kind of left of center.
Yes. But you know, it was the 50s, but there were still people in the 50s who thought women deserved equal rights. There were people 250 years ago when the Constitution was being written who thought slavery was wrong. So, you know, presentism can be a little overblown. It's, you know, basic decency towards other human beings. You can diss someone for that any era in history. That's not a new idea, that people should be treated with decency and respect.
Let my people go.
Exactly.
Now, after five
Let
seasons
her go.
On set. Yeah, exactly. That's where I was headed with that. After five seasons on Saturday Night Live, actor Leslie Jones is leaving the sketch comedy show to pursue all sorts of movie and TV projects. Up first, a reboot of the game show Supermarket Sweep, with Jones producing and hosting. Everyone is interested, including streamers and major networks, with ABC's current primetime lineup of game shows seeming a perfect fit. Jones also will likely continue covering the Olympics for NBC and has a deal with Netflix for a comedy special, because everyone has a deal with Netflix for a comedy special, except us. What are we doing talking to you when we should be talking to Netflix about our new comedy special, which we will definitely get as soon as we learn how to make jokes work? Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, but I question her people, her PR people. She announces she's leaving SNL, and the first project that launches and the first thing they mention the next day is Supermarket Sweep? That just sounds pretty low rent to me. I know she can make a lot of money on it, and I wish I was a game show host, because you work 2 months a year and you're done. But it just, I would have had something a little more prestigious and, you know, exciting to mention than that.
Well, here's the thing, you know, she also made this decision right around the time when the new cast is put together and certain people tend to not be renewed in their contracts.
Oh, they wanted Leslie Jones. Don't be ridiculous.
I'm not saying they didn't. I'm just saying that the timing is in that same ballpark. So I agree with you. They should have led with something else.
Right, but what's the timing got to do with it? They wanted her and she had to give them a final thing and say, no, I'm not coming back. There's no way they didn't want to re-sign Leslie Jones.
Oh, well, you know, everything we're talking right now, you know, so that's kind of like behind the scenes inside baseball stuff.
Ah.
And see what I did there?
I think you struck out, but keep going.
Oh, my God. That's kind of like the Dodgers over the weekend. 3 losses in a row. Good grief. Now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, and Michael tells me that I've struck out. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, a lot has happened in the streaming world. I mean, that goes without saying. Netflix and Amazon premiered some of the most critically acclaimed films of the year, as we've talked about, and they premiered them at major film festivals, and more details emerged about Apple TV and Disney Plus and the like. First up is Apple TV.
Okay, these are just rumors or well-sourced rumors, but the plan apparently is for Apple TV to charge $10 a month.
What do you think about
Disgust.
That price?
Disney Plus is asking $7. The basic Netflix or Amazon Prime is about $9. And Apple TV wants $10. Now,
here's the thing with
Apple. Quality streaming video, whatever. Who cares? But $10 a month? More than everybody else? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
they've got
five shows.
I'm not exaggerating. They have about 5 shows at launch.
I agree with you. I think part of their issue is a couple things. Apple is always the most costly of any computer equipment.
Yes, because it's the best. But 5 shows does not make them the best. If they had 50 shows that were the best, then maybe they could talk.
Yeah. I think a part of it also is like, how do you go from, let's say they came out and they said, okay, we only have 5 shows, okay? So let's not kid ourselves.
We were discussing it being free. We were like, maybe they'll give it away for free.
I knew that wasn't going to happen.
Well, I don't know. I didn't. You know, they could do a bundle.
I kind of felt like they want to get people
buy music and news, and you get Apple TV free for a year.
Okay, a year, yes. Okay, that I get.
Right,
but
well, not
forever.
Free forever, but they got five shows. How are you going to be charging for that?
Yeah, I don't know about $10. That's like, yeah, no, it just doesn't work. Yeah. But here's another thing that might not work. Saying, all right, public, we get it. We have five shows. You're not going to pay $10 a month for that. I understand. You go to get that HBO Max thing. They've got like, you know, 25 years worth of original content, and you're paying $15. Okay, so maybe we charge $5. But how in 5 or 7 years do we say now we want $10? How do we increase the price?
You keep making more shows, and you make shows they want to watch.
Right. Now, I do like what Disney Plus has done. They said $7 a month. And if you want Hulu and you want some of ESPN, not all of ESPN,
they're bundling.
Yeah, $12. Hey, guess what? Here's what I have to say to that. To whom do I make out the check?
Well, don't you already have ESPN as part of your TV bundle?
Yeah, no, I have that. But
and
what
I have
I'm
Hulu
saying
as
is
part of my as part of my
Spotify.
No, I have yes, as part of my Spotify. So I don't need that bundle.
Right. So I guess, yeah.
It's kind of a weird bundle. If you need all three, then you probably need a whole TV package, which means you need more than that.
Yeah. What am I talking about?
Well, no, it's what they should do. Just like we think Apple should bundle music, news, and Apple TV in one price. Maybe that'll be a better discount. But they need to make more shows, and they're announcing, hey, we're making the morning show. This show stars Reese Witherspoon, Jennifer Aniston, Steve Carell, and some other
me. No, it stars me. It stars everybody.
Billy,
so it might as well star me.
Billy Crudup. It's going to cost $300 million for 20 episodes for 2 seasons of the morning show. It's $300 million. That's $15 million an episode. It's the most expensive TV series in history, more than Game of Thrones. What does that make you think?
It makes me think that there are a lot of people at Apple that don't know how to make television shows.
It reminds me of every minute of every day of Hollywood. Some new person comes to town, they're Texas Oil or they're Arab Oil or they're a tech person. They've got tons of money in their pocket and they say, I want to make a movie or a TV show. That'll be fun. Let's make a movie. Like, sure, right this way. Come over here, sit down. Oh, we've got a dream project from this director. You'd love to back it. Hey, great. You know, they get people to come in, they spend tons of money and then they go home with a barrel.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and by the way, for those of you that don't know, look up barrel outfit, okay? That's wearing the barrel, meaning they've lost everything, but the barrel
that keeps
is their only clothing.
Yeah. So this just strikes me as ridiculous. Sometimes people come in and they spend a lot of money because they want to make a statement. Maybe that's what they're doing. In fact, Financial Times says Apple has, quote unquote, set aside $6 billion for programming. Well, they don't break down where or when or how much or for how long that $6 billion is going to, like, is that for 5 years, for 1 year, for 2 years, for 3 years? And frankly, with $300 million, that means $1 billion only gets you three shows.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, first of all, they're not all going to be.
No.
Yeah. But, you know, usually they say $8 billion this
year. Right, but that's not, yeah. That's specifically not what Financial Times said. They okay. made sure they were like, what does that mean? They're like, well, we're just saying they've set it aside.
Well, this is why Brian Grazer, the producer, the film producer and television producer, said in an interview recently, you know, a new streaming service or a new streaming show was just announced in the time it's taken us to finish this sentence.
Yeah, there's a
lot
of
competitors. They're popping out everywhere.
Apple has had a long history of introducing stuff or letting other people do it first, and then they step in and do it best, like the iPhone or the watch or music. Frankly, other people weren't even close to doing that best. In this case, or the laptop, frankly, in this case, other people have been doing it. Apple has stepped in, and they seem to be making every mistake under the sun because it's an entirely new thing than a product.
Now,
they may
YouTube,
figure it out, but boy, they don't know what they're doing. But Disney, I did like one other announcement before we get to YouTube. Disney said, hey, we're not dropping entire seasons. Disney Plus will drop shows once a week.
I like that. I kind of like that.
And HBO and Hulu and Amazon and perhaps Apple, they're all basically doing the same. You know, and you know why? Because they don't have that many shows. Netflix has a gazillion shows and they can afford to drop an entire season all at once. It's sort of their signature thing. But everybody else is being smarter and saying, you know what? A, we get more attention if it builds up for 5 or 6 or 10 weeks. They might release 2 or 3 episodes and then the rest 1 week at a time. It's just better for fans to consume it. It's better for us to get media about it. And we don't have that many shows. If you got five shows, people could watch it in a week and cancel their Apple subscription.
Right. Well, or their Disney subscription. Yeah, yes. Yeah. I think that I think you're absolutely right. The mass dump of shows, you know, releasing them all on the same day. That's a Netflix move. It would be like me going, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to become a singer, songwriter, musician, and I'm going to dance like nobody else. I'm going to do the moonwalk. It's like, no, that was done by somebody else. That's somebody else's signature move. You have to actually do something else. I think what Disney Plus is doing and what Apple are doing, that's smart.
Yeah, I don't think it really benefits them too much to do the dump. There's reasons why it can work and gain attention, and the whole vibe of Netflix is binge watching. You know, there's endless numbers of shows that you can binge
look
watch.
Look at HBO and Game of Thrones. If they dumped that all on the same day, they would have had a massive explosion of coverage on the first
and that's it.
The first weekend. And that would have been it. That would have been it. It would have been over.
Yeah. No, I think it's smart for most people, but I would understand why Netflix would stick to it.
I like what YouTube is doing, though. They have discovered a whole new way of doing business on television. Here's what they're going to do. They're going to allow you to not subscribe, okay? You don't have to subscribe for their original content. Instead, you can watch their content, and then every once in a while, in the middle of the content, they're going to place an advertisement. I mean, this is really unique and innovative. Nobody's ever done that before.
Yeah, so ad-supported video on demand, that is the new future for YouTube. They do have YouTube Premium, and they're sticking to it. You can watch their shows without ads, but they are going ad-supported. That's the way they're going to do it. So Cobra Kai Season 1 is now available. You can watch it for free without subscribing. You just have to watch some ads, too. They've got a bunch of new shows starting in late September, all available free. You just got to watch some ads. The shows include Liza on Demand, which has a YouTube star, Impulse, and a Johnny Cash documentary called The Gift. And weirdly, their biggest success story has been Cobra Kai, that spinoff from The Karate Kid, but they're dropping scripted shows. They're like, that's not who we are. We realize that it's YouTubers and nonfiction and short form and maybe music like Johnny Cash. That's where we live. So that's what they're going to do.
We are cat videos.
Get me
some cats.
That's right. So video on demand, they're going ad supported video on demand. There's also subscription video on demand. I don't know how you categorize like Hulu, basic Hulu, because I pay
that
for
is
it.
Subscription video on demand and with also ads. With ads. Well, it depends.
Yes, but I have ads on my Hulu because I don't pay the premium.
But most people who subscribe direct do not. So it's SVOD. They do both platforms.
But they do both platforms. Yeah, that's right. So video on demand continues to grow by leaps and bounds. It's almost doubled in the last 3 years. In 2016, video on demand was a $38 billion market worldwide. In 2017, it went up to $51 billion. And in 2018, it was $68 billion. So that's how big video on demand has become. At least 3 out of 4 U.S. households have one streaming video on demand service like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime. 3 out of 4 all U.S. households have streaming video on demand. I mean, subscription video on demand. 96% of all households can get TV. They're all now 94% of U.S. households are not TV households. They have no way of watching TV. What's wrong with them? If you have a monitor or you have access to TV via an antenna or cable or whatever, you are a TV household. That comes to about 120 million households in the upcoming season.
I will never forget being in some of the poorest areas of the world. In certain areas. And this one, I just happen to remember, it just happened to be Mexico, but I've been in other poor areas of the world where the story is the same, where, you know, literally the house is made out of mud. And I mean, you know, it's practically mud, brick, and straw.
Mud works great, yeah.
Huge television. Unbelievable. I'm like, wow, look, they have a satellite. Oh my God, they have a huge TV in there.
I remember in college when I made a bet with a friend who was an economist, and I said, oh, please, VCRs, everybody's going to want a VCR. It's crazy not to want a VCR. It's so many advantages. It's absurd. It'd be like living without a DVR today. You got to have a VCR. You have to. It's ridiculous. It's going to get to 99% penetration. He's like, no, it won't. I go, oh, it absolutely will. Nobody's not going to want a VCR. And so we made a bet, and then I realized and found out, guess what? TVs are not at 99% penetration, right? Even today, only 96% of all U.S. households have TV access. So there's 4% of U.S. households that don't. So there's no one who's going to buy a VCR if they don't have a TV.
Well, and I remember, and I may have told this story before, in 1997, working at Creative Artists Agency and begging some of the senior agents there who were in the technology world saying, look, you've got to bring these guys in that I know. They've got this thing called the digital versatile disc. Okay. Yeah. And the image is stunning. I collect laser discs, but this is even better because I don't have to turn it over. This stuff is really, it's going to be, they were like,
how could they be that dumb? Everybody knew it was a potentially big.
In 1997. Yes. By 99, everybody knew.
We knew at the beginning. We always knew it was just a matter of time. VHS was massive and Laserdisc was too expensive, but DVD was clearly, it was CD size. The player could play a CD and a DVD. They were morons. That was no insight on your part. I'm not taking you down. I'm taking them down and saying that is moronic of them not to obviously realize.
I agree. What I should have said is this is the technology that's going to pay for the next 10 years of your life.
Exactly. Well, and speaking of lives, some of them have ended.
Yes, Valerie Harper. And if you don't know who that is or it sounds familiar, you know, yes, she was an actress. And the reason you know her is because of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and her character on it, Rhoda, which wound up having its own spinoff.
That's right. She died at 80 years old after a fight with cancer. She appeared on Dancing with the Stars after getting her cancer diagnosis. She said, that's not going to slow me down. That's exactly the sort of thing, whether she's liberal or conservative. She's just an actor. People love her. You have her on the show. She's got an inspiring story. That's where Dancing with the Stars should live, not having Tom DeLay on as a dancer. But anyway, she was everyone.
And how old was she when she was on Dancing with the Stars? She was like in her 70s.
Oh, yeah, just a few years ago. So she's everyone's best friend as Rhoda. And she also fought every step of the way in her career for better pay, kind of like James Garner, who was always battling with the studios to get his fair share of profits. On her own show, Rhoda, she held out until getting a paid bump in season 2. And believe me, at that point, the show was a breakout hit. She'd won Emmys multiple times. And, you know, she was very, very popular. When Rhoda got married, 50 million people tuned in, including me. I was old enough to tune in when Rhoda got married on her own sitcom. That was a big, big TV event. And then they built the sitcom Valerie around her. That show you may not remember because it's now called The Hogan Family. It was named after her. It was built around her. Jason Bateman sort of became a breakout star as one of her kids.
I remember that.
It launched in 1986. It was a hit show, but they fired her after 2 seasons because she said, hey, this sucker's working out. I like a bit of a pay raise and more creative control. That happens. How often does that happen, Sperling? All the time, right? A show's a big hit. It's turning out well. And you say, hey, let's renegotiate, right? That is not an unusual thing. But the studio fired her. Then they sued her. She countersued and she won. She won $1.4 million and 12% of the profits. Whether she saw any of those profits, God knows, because that's another issue.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure they will, you know, like 10 years from now, they'll be like, you know, she's never received a
statement, right? Never received her character. They killed her character off and the show was renamed Valerie's Family and then the Hogan Family. But she had a great career, ultimately reunited with Mary Tyler Moore in a TV movie with their characters, you know, Mary and Rhoda being together again, you know, an iconic TV actor, Lou Grant, Ed Asner had a very sweet tribute to her online. Lots of people speaking out. You know, fun. I met her once backstage at a TV, you know, doing some live TV stuff. You know, of course she was a nice person.
Well, and you're a nice person, right, Michael.
And you're a nice person, Sperling.
Hey, it's a love fest.
It's a love fest. Send me money. I need a new microphone.
Yeah, well, either that or a new computer. Depends on which one. But in any case, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information, it's on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And that's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us. You can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Google Play Store, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Very soon on Spotify, I'm waiting for the approval. Again, when you subscribe to us, it does help us out. It helps us out when you rate and review the show on any one of those platforms. It helps other people find the show. That information, along with ways to follow us at Showbiz Sandbox, is our handle on Twitter. And you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of this information, links to all of the stories we've discussed today, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has his website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
Mare.com. That's all I could. I panicked. I wasn't thinking. But that's what Rhoda would always say to Mary. I love the thing they said. Oh. She said Mary was A friend of hers said, Mary is the person you wanted to be, Rhoda was the person you probably were, and Phyllis was the person you were afraid of becoming.
Now, didn't Mary Tyler Moore die recently too?
Mary Tyler Moore is dead. Ted Knight is dead. Georgette Engels is dead. So I think Lou Grant, Ed Asner, is one of the last standing. I'm not sure if Gavin McLeod is alive
what
or not.
What a curmudgeon he is.
Lou Grant, he's a fiery liberal.
Yeah, unbelievable. Now,
you wouldn't complain if he was on the Dancing with the Stars, would you? Yeah, you're right, I wouldn't.
Well, I might. I mean, that's like elder abuse, for Pete's sake. Now, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on whatever website he just
Gavin McLeod is still alive.
Why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work can be found? It's all aggregated there.
Or at gavinmcleodisalive.com.
Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.